This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night from 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site at thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to live shows or to our past shows on our iPod Ready archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. If you have an IKEA phone, you can also listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. Tonight we have with us a Chicago activist and Professor William Ayers. Professor Ayers was the leader of the 1960s radical group, the Weathermen. He became the center of controversy during the presidential election. Bill Ayers is currently a distinguished professor of education and senior university scholar at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Professor Ayers is the author of Teaching Toward Freedom and many other books, including Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist. Welcome to the show, Professor Ayers. Thank you for being with us this evening on the People Speak Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Were you caught off guard by the Obama-Ayers connection and the impact that it had?
Well, I was caught off guard, I suppose. It didn't have a huge impact on me. I mean, everybody has been talking about it, but actually I took it pretty much in stride. I tried not to pay much attention to it, really. It did happen, but I really tried not to pay a lot of attention to it.
Well, one of the statements that you made about it is that it was a profoundly dishonest narrative. Can you tell us how and why? In fact, you did have connections with Obama throughout, historically, little or a lot, and at one time I believe you even called him a friend.
I knew Barack Obama for a bit over a decade, and we sat on a board together, a couple of boards together, and when he said that I was a guy around the neighborhood, that's about right. He was a guy around the neighborhood. I was a guy around the neighborhood. It wasn't much more than that. He knew me probably as well as he knew thousands of other people, and no one knew back then that he was going to be the president of the United States, so you didn't mark in your calendar every time you saw him. He was somebody that you saw, at a coffee shop or this or that. But when I say that the narrative was dishonest, I mean a couple of things. One is, the construction of a monster, a beast, called Bill Ayers, or called Reverend Jeremiah Wright, or called Rashid Khalidi, that's profoundly dishonest. There is no beast with that name. There is no one-dimensional character. And the reduction of, say, Jeremiah Wright, who has a long and rich and robust history of struggle in the Black Freedom Movement and in the South Side of Chicago, to reduce him to a single sermon and a single moment and a single phrase is profoundly dishonest. And to play that all over and over again is to create a big lie. So that's one way in which it's dishonest. The second way it's dishonest, and this is probably more serious for our politics and our future, is that you cannot assert that because two people shared a boardroom or a bus ride or a cup of coffee or saw each other on the street, that they therefore are responsible for one another's politics, one another's policies, one another's outlooks. And that's guilt by association. And it's a terrible, terrible tradition in American politics, and it's something we should reject, and I think to some extent we did reject it this time around.
Do you think this was just a poor attempt at fear-mongering, Professor?
Well, I think it was an attempt at fear-mongering. I think it was a corrupt and bankrupt strategy from the start. You'd have to kind of check with the McCain people about what they were possibly thinking, but for sure they did not seem to have any vibrant ideas or any thoughts about, how the country might move forward in any hopeful or optimistic way. And They therefore pulled out all the dirty tricks they could think of. And again, it was Jeremiah Wright, it was Rashid Khalidi, it was me, it was other people. But the theme was, you know, Barack Obama is somehow a mystery. We don't really know about him. And that was the theme that kept coming up. What do we really know about this man? Now, the truth is, we knew a lot about him. The country knew a lot about him. And what you see is what you get. So this was a kind of a fear-mongering, a kind of attempt to sow doubt in people's minds. And I think it failed. And I think that's good.
Pat Buchanan had said that Barack Obama had run one of the most pristine elections in the history of elections. Do you agree with that statement?
True. I think that's probably true. He never did get fully into the gutter, did he? And I think that's to his credit.
And obviously the opportunity to, as you said, get into the gutter probably was ripe for him, considering the infamous past that you've had as a member of the Weathermen.
Well, that was, as Obama himself kept saying, I was 8 years old. I don't know what responsibility he's supposed to take for that. You know, I'm 64 years old, and it's true that I've been an anti-war activist my whole adult life, that I've been on the progressive side of political struggles my whole adult life. I've been a movement builder and a believer in popular movements my whole adult life. But because I knew the president-elect doesn't mean that he thought those things or that he felt that way or that he endorsed anything I had done or anything I was doing currently. We sat on a board where we gave money to community organizations that were trying to alleviate the effects of poverty in communities that were marginalized and oppressed in the city of Chicago. This was not any kind of a radical undertaking. This was an attempt to give people voice who were voiceless. This was an attempt to realize the kind of dreams of democracy that most people have. And on that board sat Republicans and Democrats and people like me who are independents. So it wasn't, in no way did we share political philosophy on that board.
Let me ask you, one of the very first times that you were with Barack Obama was in your home in a coffee, evening with coffee scenario. Was there a selection process for these little at-home gatherings, and were you selected, or is this something that you volunteered to do?
Well, first of all, our home, for the whole time we've lived in Chicago, is a pretty much an open public space. We have fundraisers here all the time. We have community organizations meeting here. My partner and I each meet with our students here and have classes here. So our home is pretty much an open spot in Hyde Park, and there's nothing unusual about someone asking us to provide a venue to gather together some folks. As I understand it, when Barack Obama decided to run for political office, I had met him a little bit earlier than that. His people organized dozens of these all over the city. It was kind of a, and it's not unusual. This is true in a lot of political campaigns in a lot of cities. He wanted to meet a lot of people. He wanted to make his pitch. He wanted to refine his pitch. And we were asked by the sitting state senator, Alice Palmer, who was a friend, and Alice was stepping aside and kind of endorsing this brilliant young man. And she asked us, would we host a coffee? She asked, and of course we said yes, because we say yes to everybody. And of course, for a long time in the last year, people said, wow, I guess I can't run for president because I've been palling around with you. And now I say back to them, not only can you run, you can win.
You can win.
It just turned out not to be so poisonous after all.
That's wonderful. For those who have just joined us, our interview tonight is with Professor William Ayers of the infamous Weathermen. You probably get really sick of hearing that, don't you?
Well, to me, the Weathermen were, you know, one thing, but not the only thing that I've done.
Absolutely, and we're going to talk about some of those things. For those of you, again, that have just joined us, you can call at 877-489-6350 or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. And you can talk to Mr. Ayers and ask him a question if you'd like. Let me ask you, David Horowitz, who considers you to be one of the 100 most dangerous academics in America. And if I know David Horowitz, and I think I do, he is attacking you not only as an academic, but as a free thinker and critical thinker. Not necessarily so much for your connection of in your child politics connection with President-elect Obama. What do you think about that? How does it feel to be considered one of the most dangerous academics in America?
Well, you know, David Horowitz put together this list. It was kind of a public relations thing on his part, but he's an ultra-right-wing commentator and kind of talking head, and he's also an apostate who was once the editor of Ramparts and has now seen the light. He organized Democrats for Reagan, or Radicals for Reagan, I guess it was called, in 1980. And he's been moving farther and farther to the right. What Horowitz's campaign is on campuses is to say that all these radicals are ensconced in academia and we've got to kind of root them out. And Horowitz is leading a very dangerous campaign. And the campaign, you know, it's not even targeting people like me. Look, I'm a tenured professor. I've been here for 21 years and I'm not really worried about what David Horowitz says about me. But if you think about it, the whole concept of challenging people for being critical, for being radical, for thinking outside of the normal paradigms. I mean, if we don't, and this is part, it goes back to this question of guilt by association. I think it's a virtue that a presidential candidate or someone running for higher office would talk to thousands upon thousands or millions of people in this wildly diverse society, get lots of opinions, and at the end of the day, have a mind of your own. In terms of Horowitz's attack on academia, what he wants is to create the conditions where people think, you know, in lockstep. The right to think is what's at stake. And it's not really the university that I worry about. What I worry about is if he attacks people like me, or if Ward Churchill loses his job, or if Norman Finkelstein is driven out of DePaul, all things that have happened, what does that mean to the teacher of high school social studies on the west side of Chicago? What chance does that person have to raise questions about the status quo, to raise criticism about the direction of the country? That person has no chance, and so it creates a chilling effect, not just at the university, where you learn that if you want to get tenure, if you want to get along, you go along. Do your research, but don't do it on anything like Israel, Palestine, because that'll get you fired. Do your research, but don't do it on anything like Native American rights, because that will get you fired. And it has a much more chilling effect in high schools and junior highs and the whole intellectual climate of the country.
Very interesting. And I think that Horowitz could be Dershowitz's brother.
Well, in some ways, Dershowitz has, of course, been terrible in Israel-Palestine. He's not as terrible in other things, but... but, yeah, together they kind of become a team, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And it squelches free thought. And if you think about it, without the dissidents, without the critical thinkers, we would still, women would still lack the right to vote. You know, we would still be enslaving our fellow human beings. Somebody has to step out of the conventional, of the kind of norms of the way things are, and say, I don't agree with this, this is wrong, and then begin to kind of challenge and enter into dialogue. That's what universities should be about. That's what high schools should be about.
You know, we have a caller on line two. Dawn from North Carolina is on the line. Excuse me. Dawn, do you have a question for Professor Ayers?
I certainly do. Mr. Ayers or Dr. Ayers, there's been a huge controversy about Barack Obama's birth certificate. And I wanted to know, what do you think about the fact that he won't simply produce the original certificate? And what do you think about the fact that all his records, including his academic records, are closed to public inspection?
I have no idea about that. I'm learning it for the first time from you. I know nothing about it. I'm not an expert on these kind of things.
Well, thank you for your question, Don. In a statement about the issues facing academia today, you made a comment about some, what I think to be very, very critical issues, that there are certain entities operating with a very, very clear ideological purpose One, to control all three branches of the federal government. Two, to control many state governments. And three, to control the media. Who are the major players here, Professor Ayers, and how does one stand a chance of stopping them?
I'm not an expert on what you're asking me. I mean, I think that when I look at the last 8 years, I think those 8 years in the federal government have been ideologically driven, and I think the ideology that's driven them is something that is frightening, narrowing, horrifying in some ways, and it's led us into an endless war on two fronts at this point, maybe three fronts, and more to come. I think people in November voted against the last 8 years. They voted against the politics of fear and terror and endless war, the politics of hunkering down and letting things go to hell. So I think that people were voting against the era of 9/11, and in a sense voting for the era of yes we can. Yes we can remains an open question. Yes we can what? And I think that part of our responsibility is, if you think about the last 8 years and the ideological orientation of it and so on, part of our responsibility is to reframe many of the debates. And when I say we, I mean the American people, the American citizens. So one thing we should reframe completely is foreign policy. We've kind of suffered under a foreign policy based on the assumption that we're safe if we have a huge military and invade anybody that we choose to invade. That's a foreign policy that will leave us vulnerable and unbalanced. I mean, it will leave us in a much worse place. And we should be arguing for a foreign policy based on justice, a foreign policy based on being a nation among nations, not the uber nation lording it over everyone else. Similarly, we've kind of been sold a bill of goods around economic policy that what's good for the wealthy will be good for all of us. That's been proven to be untrue, and yet we've labored under that for decades. We should begin to say and press demands and insist on and activate ourselves around the notion that we should invest in people, not in the wealthy, that we should invest in human beings, human labor. And so these are the kinds of things we have to rethink, I believe, in this period, and build a social movement that can make sure they come to pass.
We have a question in text from John from the Canadian Rockies. The question is, Dr. Ayers, I witnessed some hate speech directed at you in text. I wonder if you would address the role of hatred in America in the 21st century. Where does it come from and where does it go? Thank you in advance.
I'm not sure, again, that I have any particular insights, but I certainly was the object of a fair amount of hate during the campaign. And I felt sometimes like the character in George Orwell's novel 1984, who was cast up on the screen and he was the enemy of the party, and they had what they called the 2 minutes hate, where people worked themselves into a frenzy. And of course, it was a diversion from people's real problems. I think that the kind of politics of hate, the reduction of people into roles as kind of monsters, which, as I said, I think is what happened to Jeremiah Wright and so on. All of this is distracting from the real problems that we face. All of it is a sidetrack rather than the mainstream. And so I feel very strongly that we should, learn to reject those kinds of 2 minute sound bites, those kind of reductions, those kind of stereotypings, and we should learn to talk to one another. And that means creating, which is essential to a democracy, creating the conditions where we can have dialogue with one another. We don't have to agree in advance in order to begin a discussion. Each of us should learn to talk with the possibility of being heard and listen with the possibility of being changed. That's what dialogue is. That's what democracy is. And so much of the hate coming through the blogosphere or through 24-hour cable news, so much of it really undermines that sense of a democratic spirit where we might learn something and we might move forward together.
We have a question from Frank in Seattle for Professor Ayers. And for those of you that have just joined us, our interview this evening is with Professor William Ayers. author, activist, some say terrorist. I guess you've got a lot of titles to juggle these days. Frank in Seattle, what is your opinion of the Obama cabinet, and do you see it as a contradiction to change?
Well, I'll tell you, my sense of where we all are, so many of us became real political junkies over the last couple of years, and we couldn't get up or breathe in the morning without checking the blogs and checking the polls. And I think we're suffering a little bit of postpartum depression right now. There's no polls to check, and therefore we spend our time kind of reading the tea leaves and trying to understand what's in the mind of the president-elect. I think we're looking in the wrong direction, and I'll tell you why. It's not because I think that his appointments are particularly good. I don't think they're particularly good. But it is because what moves history forward is what we do. The president will follow, the administration will follow what we do. In fact, one of the smartest things that Senator Obama said during the campaign, when he was asked who would Martin Luther King support, his response was, King wouldn't support any of us. He'd be in the streets demanding justice. And it reminds me that we should note that Lyndon Johnson, who passed far-reaching civil rights legislation, was never in the civil rights movement. And Franklin Roosevelt was never in the labor movement. And Abraham Lincoln did not belong to an abolitionist party. And yet each of these men is identified with a movement because the movement demanded certain things happen, and they were in a position where they could use their political skills to make certain things happen. Our job, it seems to me, is not to read anybody's mind. It's not to try to figure out, are things going well or are they going badly? We're in the midst of the most profound economic crisis probably in a century. We're in the midst of not only two wars and a militarized economy, we're in the midst of a situation where the United States is going to have to rethink and reconfigure its role in the world. It will no longer be the empire that it's been for the last several decades. That's a huge shift, and what you and I do is going to make all the difference in terms of whether those shifts are in a direction that's progressive and hopeful and humane, or whether those things are catastrophic for us and for the world. It's up to us. I think we have to get busy building social movements, and I think there is a vibrant peace movement. We should all participate in it. There's vibrant movement for gay and lesbian rights. We should participate in it. There's a vibrant movement for environmental justice. We should participate in it, and we should make the connections, not just against the war, but seeing that war and warming are linked, seeing that the scapegoating of gay and lesbian people is linked to the shredding of our civil rights, and so on.
As so many activists, including Professor Howard Zinn on our show, have said, do something, do anything, just don't do nothing.
Well, exactly. In a world as out of balance as this world, if you do something, you'll be drawing yourself into the fray, and that's the beginning.
Absolutely. Carla from North Carolina is on line two. Carla, your question for Professor Ayers, please.
Yes, I was just wondering if the U.S. government, do you think they'll ever be recognized as a completely non-religious government? Because it seems like the whole rift between the left and the right is because the right is saying, oh, no, we're not going over to that side because they are far too secular, and the left is saying, we're not going over to the right side because they're too evangelical. Is there ever going to come a point where we can all just get along?
Well, I think we should fight for it, and I think we should struggle for it. And part of what that means, it seems to me, is no one can ask people, you know, to leave their religious faith outside of their entry into the public square. In other words, when people come into the public square, of course they bring their faith with them. I understand that. But nor can we allow people to make arguments within the public square that are all based on faith. In other words, you have to base your argument about, say, your position on women's rights or on gay and lesbian rights. You can't make the argument in the public square that your religion tells you to do it such and such a way, or your religion demands, or your God says, do this, because that doesn't convince someone who doesn't share your God. And we are a secular society. Therefore, it's okay that you bring your values, your faith values, into the public square, but you are required to make your arguments based on evidence and not based on what God told you. And I think that's a very important distinction. So freedom of religion means you're free to believe anything you want. You can practice it any way you want. And you can even bring your feelings about it into the public space. But in the public space, you have to make arguments that are convincing to people who don't buy into your religious outlook. That's a hard thing, but it's an important thing.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll return in just a couple of minutes or so with Professor William Ayers, professor at Illinois University in Chicago, and recently made once again infamous by the Obama campaign. Thank you for being with us, and we'll be back in just a minute.
We used to write letters to each other a lot, and it was intimidating to talk to him sometimes because he just seemed so isolated by himself.
She started talking about how she wishes that her life was over and she wishes that she was never born.
So I knew he had depression, but I didn't know it was that far.
Said something to me about killing himself.
Tell somebody, tell an adult, counselor, parent, whatever.
It's a hard situation because you do risk making that person very angry and losing their friendship.
It would have been horrible for me if she never talked to me again, but I'd live with it because I know she'd be alive.
Definitely worth getting help, even if you think you're going to lose a friendship, because it's better to lose the friendship than the actual friend.
Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens. For more information, contact the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 888-333-AFSP, or online at afsp.org.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world for the broken.
This land is your land. This land is mine.
Hello, everybody. Basma Farhad on the People Speak Radio with our guest, Professor William Ayers. Professor Ayers is a teacher extraordinaire. He is an anti-war activist. He was a fugitive in his life and gained some incredible publicity during the Obama campaign, which was kind of interesting. You know, Professor, one of the things that I'd like to touch upon is this issue of your work in academia. I have a very important question that I've always wondered about. Do we in America really want to educate our children?
Well, you know, it's one of the things I spend most of my time and energy thinking about is where are we in the educational discussion, the educational debate? I feel like we have to make a very important, I said earlier, you know, that we have to change the frame of some of these discussions. In education, we have to change the frame profoundly. And what I suggest is that we ought to notice that education in any society, whether it's an authoritarian society or a democratic society, whether it's apartheid South Africa or medieval Saudi Arabia or Soviet Russia or the United States, all of those educational systems agree. The kids shouldn't do drugs, the kids should show up on time, the kids should learn their subject matters. So the question I have is, what makes education in a democracy distinct? And I would argue, and do argue consistently, that in a democracy, we believe in the incalculable value of every human being. That's what democracy is based on. Every human being is the equal to every other human being. And therefore, we must create an educational system based on that principle that the full development of the entire community is the condition for the full development of each individual. Now, we can hold that standard up. We can ask ourselves, in an authoritarian society, don't they want to educate children to be obedient and conforming and find their rightful place in the hierarchy of society? I think they do. In a democracy, don't we want to teach imagination, courage, initiative, the right to have a mind of one's own? I think we do. We then need to look at our schools on the west side of Chicago or in the South Bronx or in L.A., and we have to ask ourselves, are we living up to that democratic ideal in education? And I think the answer is not yet, and there's much, much more to do. So we have in this country, you know, an educational system that is broken in many ways, that certainly is unfair to many, many people, and that's what we need to struggle to change in education.
Well, you know, in the United States here, by the time a young person graduates from university, they're facing an unbelievable and unfathomable burden of perhaps $60,000 to $75,000 or more in school loans. We are now actually becoming more career-oriented universities rather than universities of higher education and expansion of a person's mind or a child's mind.
That's
so, once again, does America really want to educate its children, or are we raising a disposable generation for these wars that we're opening up that virtually have no end?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it's something we need to, there is no definitive answer to it, but I think we know what side you and I want to be on. We want to fight for an education that's rich and complex and deep. And we want to, I mean, there's one place we could start, for example. I think our educational system is broken in many ways. I was trying to give an overview of what I think the profound problem is and how we have to rethink it. But it's also true that American students overwhelmingly don't have a sense of geography, don't have a sense of history, don't have a sense of our place in the world. So the National Geographic did a survey a couple years ago of 18 to 25-year-old Americans. They showed them a blank world map. And something like 80% couldn't find Iraq. 80% couldn't find Israel-Palestine. Something close to 40% couldn't find Great Britain. I mean, that's an outrageous condemnation of our educational system. Because if you can't find Palestine, Israel, and you can't find Iraq, then you're living in a world where you're blind to the reality that's out there. I ask my students, what percentage of the world's population lives in the United States? And guesses range from 10% to 40%. The truth is it's less than 5%. But if we are anesthetized by our privilege into believing that, you know, that we are the center of the universe and no one else counts the way we count, we are in for some very, very bad times and not too far in the future. So I want our educational system to be more rigorous, more complicated, more demanding, but also more fair, more democratic, more inclusive, more just.
Your wife, Bernadine Dorn, is also an educator and highly involved with helping children. This question is from Mike in California. Do you also help with kids?
Well, she and I have written a couple of books together. We have a book coming out in January called Race Course. The subtitle is Against White Supremacy. We've written a book on zero tolerance together. We've done a couple of other writings together. But we tend to be working in different arenas, but around the same goals, which we consider to be humanistic goals, goals of transformation, student-centered, humane-centered goals. She's a law professor at Northwestern University, and I'm a professor of education. But I've written about kids in jail, which is something that she introduced me to, that she knew much more about. And I've introduced her to urban schools. So we share a lot of the same territory. We are both focused on children, but she is really a legal scholar and focused on legal issues.
Wonderful. We have a listener on the line, Isa from North Carolina. I guess North Carolina is wide awake this evening. Is on line four. Isa, you have a question for Professor Ayers?
Yes, I do. And good evening, Mr. Ayers, and to our host. Mr. Ayers, I grew up at the time that the Weathermen were doing their campaign. Now, in Islam, we were taught that the murder of one human being is the same as murdering an entire human race.
That's true.
And that the preservation of one life is like preserving the entire human race.
That's true. That's from the Talmud also,
now,
yeah.
Looking back on the deaths associated with the Weathermen operation, okay, do you feel that they were tragedy? And if you had to do it all over again, would you ensure that no people died as a result of your actions?
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to, because it's been all over the right-wing blogosphere that we killed a whole bunch of people, including police. It's not true. The only deaths attributed that were involved with the Weathermen were the three people who themselves killed themselves, and that's when the Weather Underground was born, in March of 1970. And that was an unspeakable tragedy, and I agree with you. A whole universe disappeared with each of those deaths. But let's set the context. Let's understand what was going on. The United States was involved in this war against Vietnam. It began in 1965 in earnest. I was arrested opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965 and arrested several times over the next 3 years. From 1965 to 1968, the American people went from about 70% supporting the war to about 60% opposing the war. 3 years, and the tide turned. Why? Well, partly because of the efforts of the anti-war movement, partly because the Black Freedom Movement came out very strongly. Martin Luther King, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, came out very strongly against the war. In fact, SNCC said no black man should go 10,000 miles to fight for a so-called freedom he doesn't enjoy in Mississippi. King said that this was the greatest purveyor of violence on earth was the United States government. So that turned the tide. But most decisively, when veterans came home and told the truth about what they were asked to do there, when John Kerry, a young officer, went before the U.S. Senate and said, we committed crimes against humanity every day, not by accident or by choice, but as a matter of policy, that turned the country against the war. So in the spring of 1968, a sitting president said, I will not run for re-election. I will work to end the war. And we all celebrated wildly. It's true that 1 million people were killed in those 3 years, but it was also true that the war was going to end, and we were ebullient. We were ecstatic. 5 days later, Martin Luther King was killed. 2 months after that, Robert Kennedy was killed. And 2 months after that, it was clear that the war would not end. The war would expand. And every month that the war went on, every month, 2,000 innocent people would be murdered, mostly from the air. And at that point, the peace movement splintered. Why did it splinter? Because we couldn't figure out how to stop the war. Some people joined the Democratic Party and worked within it to build a peace wing. Some people went into the factories of the Northeast and tried to organize the industrial working class. Some people ran away to Europe or Africa. And we built a clandestine organization in an attempt to not, you know, give in to what we saw as an escalating repression, but also to make the war painful for the war makers. And do I think we were brilliant or wonderful or leading? No, I don't. I never said we were. And my memoir, Fugitive Days, in no way makes a claim that we were fantastic. But it attempts only to understand how this young man and others sat down in this historical moment, made these extreme choices in a world in flames, a world on fire. And so, do I defend what we did? Not exactly. Do I think the tragedy of those three deaths was unspeakable? I do. But on the other hand, I don't think that those three deaths are more important than three deaths in Vietnam. So, as you yourself said, each death is an entire universe obliterated. Well, how about 2,000 universes obliterated by our government every month? How do you stop it? How does that unspeakable crime get brought to the forefront? And I'm not saying that what we did was great, but I understand why we did it. And I don't think that you can condemn us without also condemning the mass murder that was policy for our government.
Thank you very much for your answer. I hope I say you are satisfied with that answer. Scott from Canada is on line two. Scott, do you have a question for Professor Ayers, please?
Yes, I'd like him to provide some commentary on one of the things that I really believe in, and that's we need to empower our children with self-worth in the school system. And one of the tools that I believe we can do that is creating mentoring programs in the school system to where we have peer-to-peer mentoring so that we can actually instill a sense of self-worth in the students as they mentor other students. And I just wanted your comments on that.
I think it's a great idea. I mean, I think there's many, many things that we need to do in the schools, but certainly every student should find in school a teacher who is caring and thoughtful and talented and well compensated and well rested. Every student should find that. And every student should find a place in school where there are things that are familiar to him or her and things that stretch him or her. So every student should feel both comfortable, should feel spotlighted, should feel valuable, should feel valued, just like we do in a good family. A good family is a place where every person feels valuable and valued. And what the wisest and best parents want for that their children, that's what we as a society have to demand for all children, because all children are the responsibility of us as a collective.
We have a question from Ted in Florida. And Ted's question is, why aren't the youth of today taking more militant stands against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan like they did in your day against Vietnam? Do you think people today are complacent?
You know, I think that privilege does make us all complacent. But no, I actually have a lot of admiration for this generation, and I have very little nostalgia for the 60s generation. I mean, we were not perfect or wonderful, or, you know, we did take some militant steps against the war, but we have to temper that with the understanding that we didn't end the war. We fought the war for 10 years, and we paid a price personally and collectively in fighting against that war. But we didn't stop the war. And so I don't want to heroize or glorify the movement of the 60s, nor do I want to completely diss people today. I mean, the largest anti-war demonstration I ever went on was in March 2003, and that was before George Bush even pulled the trigger in Iraq. So one of the problems with that demonstration was it was kind of promoted as the demonstration that will stop a war from happening. Well, that was a little grandiose. We couldn't stop the war from happening. On the other hand, I think that people have found interesting new ways to resist. I don't think the rhetoric of resistance from the 60s travels very well. So I don't think we should be counting heads and saying how big was the demonstration. I think the anti-war sentiment in this country is deep and wide, and it is our job to somehow mobilize it and direct it at the people who can bring this war to a swift end. And let's remember too that the so-called war on terror, which is a myth, that war has no end, has no fronts, has no limit to the number of countries that might be invaded. And we should insist that there is no war on terror. Terrible crime was committed, which requires a criminal justice response. But it doesn't require regime change in two countries. It doesn't require wholesale support of Israel against the Palestinian people. It requires rather a more temperate, a more thoughtful response. So we should not invade Afghanistan at a higher level. We should not go into neighboring countries in that region. We should insist that our best security, our best hope, is really in becoming a nation among nations and learning how to talk across the borders of background, culture, history, and condition.
Professor Ayers, in one of your books, you described the weathermen as descending into a whirlpool of violence. I asked you a question on our break, and I asked, when does resistance become terror?
Well, I think that, terror is a word that has been thrown around, and it means almost anything. But I believe that we can make a stable definition of terror. And the stable definition is encoded in the U.S. Criminal Code. It's encoded in the United Nations. And basically what it says is that terror is an organized campaign of mass destruction, including assassinations and kidnappings, and violence and murder and the threat of violence in order to intimidate and overwhelm a population. And if that's our definition, and I'm willing to stick with that, if that's our definition of terrorism, then it's true that groups of people, religious fanatics, political organizations, parties, can conduct terror campaigns. But it's equally true, and this is terribly important, it's equally true that governments can conduct terror campaigns. And throughout history, we have seen this. I mean, what is Russia's role in Chechnya, if not terror? What is the U.S. role in Vietnam, if not terror? France and Algeria, Israel and Palestine. You know, Sherman's March to the Sea, if you want to get into something where we agreed with Sherman, but at the same time, we don't agree that he had the right to burn the South and murder women and children and intimidate a population. Those are all acts of official terror. And in my view, if you look back, and I think this is easily provable, the most violence and the most terror and the most human destruction that's taken place is the terror of organized governments, not the terror of the religious fanatic or the political cult. Just not true. On the other hand, I think terror is always wrong. It's always to be condemned. You cannot kill innocents. You cannot overwhelm people with violence and have any justification for it. So I think it's always wrong. It should always be condemned. But we shouldn't fall into this hypocritical notion that if you fight against an established government, whether you kill people or not, you're automatically a terrorist. Whereas if you are an established government, you don't commit terror. The government of the United States has been a terrorist state in Vietnam and in Iraq.
I'm not an advocate of violence, and I don't think I ever will be as
either.
A Palestinian.
We agree.
And yet, at the same time, there was a time when you engaged in certain types of violent behavior. I'm sure that since then you've had a lot of time to reflect on those moments. How do you feel about violence and stopping violence with violence today?
Well, the funny thing about, the odd thing about thinking about this is, look, we live in a whirlpool of violence. You and I live in violence right now, and we can kind of buffer ourselves from it. We don't have to look at it. And the reason we don't have to look at it, among other things, is that the U.S. media has been banned from any battlefield that the U.S. is involved in since 1975. So we don't know what's going on. You can't see the war unless you look at foreign media outlets or independent outlets. It's very hard to see what's going on. But certain situations, certain relationships are violent by their nature. And you and I then don't have a choice about whether we're to be violent or nonviolent. The hypothetical that I could give you is very simple. During the days of slavery, who could be nonviolent? It was a violent system. It was a system based on violence. And even if a slave owner was kind and paid his bills on time and didn't ever beat anybody, still, that system was a violent system maintained by violence. So, for those like the Harriet Tubman, who carried a pistol in her pocket, or Frederick Douglass, or John Brown, who resisted that violence, they were then labeled the violent ones. But were they? Is that fair? It seems to me they were fighting to end a system of violence. In my case, the violence was so overwhelming and so in front of us, and what we chose to do was destruction of property in order to raise a screaming alarm against that violence and in order to make it more painful for the government to go forward with its violent campaign. I don't see how you can compare the destruction of property or the burning of my draft card, which I did several times, or the burning of draft files, which I did on more than one occasion, or the breaking of windows in the Pentagon. I don't see how you can compare that to 2,000 people a month being murdered.
Professor, in reflection, what would you have changed during your youth?
Oh, so many things, but, I'm 64 years old, so there's a lot to regret and a lot to want to change. But I guess I would say this, that, I regret very much that in the years of the student movement, as we became more frustrated and more unable to end this war, we resorted to a kind of self-righteousness, a kind of certainty that we were right. So I think that kind of dogma, sectarianism, certainty, self-righteousness, these are things that we definitely, these were political errors that we made. And what I advise young people today, always, is to think of a certain rhythm to resistance. On the one hand, you must open your eyes and see the injustices in the world. But secondly, you have to act on whatever injustices you see. But most important also is that you doubt or you reconsider whether everything you did was so brilliant. You have to open your eyes, act, and doubt, and then you have to act again, and then you have to doubt again. If you don't doubt, you become self-righteous. If you don't act, you become cynical.
You have a number of books coming out, I understand. One of them, Teaching Toward Freedom. Another, Handbook of Social Injustice in Education. What other books do you have coming out for the community?
Teaching Toward Freedom is out, and Fugitive Days is out. I think I have 20 books in print. And then what's coming out in the near future is the Handbook of Teaching for Social Justice, which is publication date is tomorrow. And then I have a book coming out in January that I wrote with Bernadine Dorn called Race Course Against White Supremacy. And in the summer, I have a comic book coming out, a graphic novel based on a book I wrote called To Teach. And it'll be out in comic book form. And I'm very excited about that.
Comic book, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I'm happy about it. Reach a new audience.
Absolutely. As a teacher in metaphysics, I often had to reflect on my position students in the lives and the minds of a student, and I had to question what being a teacher was. And for me, I came up with this: being a teacher is to lie upon the raging waters of life and become a bridge that the student can walk across.
Damn, I love that. I always call students unruly sparks of meaning-making energy on a voyage of discovery and surprise, and I want to be on that voyage with them. But I love that. I love that. You have to send that to me. Brilliant.
I will do that. Thank you very much, Professor Ayers, for being with us. Good, bad, or indifferent, here is a man that has not held anything back. He's been open and he's been honest. I guess future generations will have their way with judging you one way or the other. I, for one, say that please continue to teach our students. We need them to learn. We need them to grow.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And next week, Ali Abu Na'ma of the Electronic Intifada, the founder and journalist.
Another friend of mine and a Chicagoan, incidentally.
Yes, he is. Ali's a great guy. I'm really glad to have him. I've met him a number of times in various enterprises.
Have a great show. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Professor Ayers. You have a great evening. Thank you for being with us. Okay, guys, that's it for the night. Let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of that summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and